jeszcze nigdy tak jak dziś. Nie miał w sobie takiej siły i może to ten deszcz, może przez tą mgłę, ale w każdej twarzy ciągle widzę cię. Wśród turystów rynek tonie znów. Ktoś zakrzyknął głośno, błysnął flesz. Na gołębie twój płaszcz zaczepił mnie w wystawowym oknie w tłumie gdzieś. Widzę cię, tak wiem. Nie zrobię więcej zdjęć, tak wiem. Nie będę prosił, lecz tak wiem. To przecież żaden grzech, tak wiem.
Kraków hejnał gra, tak wita mnie. Patrzy na mnie, jakby wiedział, że wracam po tobie, choć na kilka chwil zamknąć oczy i móc uwierzyć, że widzę cię, tak wiem. Nie zrobię więcej zdjęć, tak wiem. Nie będę prosił, lecz tak wiem. To przecież żaden grzech, tak wiem.
Widzę cię, tak wiem. Nie zrobię więcej zdjęć, tak wiem. Nie będę prosił, lecz tak wiem. To przecież żaden grzech, tak wiem.
Moje Polskie Radio.pl. To ja, Piotr Stelmach. Polecam Państwu ofensywę.
Still alive, if woman can survive, they may find. In the year 35, ain't gonna need to tell the truth, tell no lies. Everything you think, do, and say is in the pill you took today. In the year 45, ain't gonna need your teeth, won't need your eyes. You won't find a thing to chew, nobody's gonna look at you. In the year 55, your arms are hanging limp at your sides. Your legs got nothing to do, some machine doing that for you. In the year 65, ain't gonna need no husband, won't need no wife. You pick your son, pick your daughter too, from the bottom of a long glass tube. Whoa, whoa. In the year 75, 10, if God's a-coming, he ought to make it by then. Maybe he'll look around himself and say, guess it's time for the judgment day. In the year 85, 10, God is gonna shake his mighty head. He'll either say, I'm pleased where man has been, or tear it down and start again. Oh, oh. In the year 95, 95, I'm kinda wondering if man is gonna be alive. He's taken everything this old earth can give, and he ain't put back nothing. Whoa, whoa. Now it's been 10,000 years. Man has cried a billion tears for what he never knew. Now man's reign is through, but through eternal night, the twinkling of starlight, so very far away, maybe it's only yesterday. In the year
101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Check out Bed Bath & Beyond, HP and Apple computers at student pricing, and rental books at your UBC bookstore. Rental saves you 55%. Win a term's worth of rental books, a Norco Kathmandu bicycle, or a dorm room supply set. Details in-store or check the new website, bookstore.ubc.ca.
Good morning, CITR 101.9. Thanks to everybody who gave out the money. I'm going to do a rebroadcast now for the next 50-something minutes from KPFA in San Francisco, Michael Chudovsky, who's my favorite professor of economics in the world. And we'll start. There's a couple of show IDs. Don't worry about it. They're Americans, but this is cool. And he's from Montreal.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
What I think is of concern to us is that the 9/11 big lie sets the stage for what I describe as the American Inquisition. The nature of an inquisitorial doctrine is very different to actual disinformation. There's a subtle difference, because media disinformation is that you hide the facts and you obfuscate certain things and you lie. An inquisitorial doctrine is quite different. You don't necessarily need to lie. You don't obfuscate the torture camps in Guantanamo. In fact, you do exactly the opposite. You make them visible. Why? Because ultimately they are accepted as something which we can do. So torture then is accepted because we need to go after the bad guys, okay? So that an inquisitorial doctrine is based on, essentially, on enforcing the lie as the truth. Okay, it's not by obfuscating the truth and saying, no, well, this, that, and other. It's actually inverting the truth. It's transforming the lie into the truth.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Michelle Chosorowski. Today's show, Al-Qaeda and the Global War on Terrorism. Michelle Chosorowski is a professor of economics and director of the Center for Research on Globalization based in Montreal, Quebec. He is the author of The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, and America's War on Terrorism. He is co-editor and contributor to a new anthology, The Global Economic Crisis, The Great Depression of the 21st Century. Today, Michelle Chosorowski discusses the broad consequences of 9/11 with regard to U.S. military doctrine, and more broadly, the pretext and justification which the lies surrounding 9/11 have given to waging a war of conquest under the banner of what we call the Global War on Terrorism. This presentation was given on September 9th, 2011, at the Toronto hearings. Michelle Chosorowski.
You'll excuse us because we've just arrived from Montreal together with Cynthia McKinney and Marlene Azabroya. And we just had about 5 minutes to rush to the event. What I'd like to address in my presentation are the broad consequences of 9/11 with regard to U.S. military doctrine, but more broadly, the pretext and justification which the lies surrounding 9/11 have given to waging a war of conquest under the banner of what we call the War on Terrorism, or the Global War on Terrorism, which we could call the GWAT. Now, the GWAT was launched. I thought this was going to be a serious presentation. The Global War on Terrorism was launched late at night by the War Cabinet, which was formed in the afternoon of 9/11. And a decision was taken to declare war on Afghanistan as a state sponsor of the 9/11 attacks. In other words, a sovereign country somewhere in Central Asia, on the grounds that Al-Qaeda and mastermind Osama bin Laden was behind these attacks, and consequently Afghanistan as hosting Al-Qaeda was responsible for a military attack on the United States of America. And what is more important is that the following morning, without any evidence, nobody knew who had done it, you know, on the same day. But the following morning, Eastern European time in Brussels, the Atlantic Alliance met and invoked Article 5 of the Treaty of Washington, which essentially states that an attack on one of its members constitutes an attack on all of its members under the concept of collective defense. Now, immediately we see unfolding this notion of preemptive war, that this was an act of defense. This was a decision on the part of NATO to defend itself against the attack of a foreign country, and as a result, NATO NATO didn't actually declare war on the 12th. It waited until barely two or three days before, based on some State Department document, which was composed and never verified. And then they said, yes, we now rubber stamp the decision that we took tentatively on September the 12th. But needless to say, this tragic event of 9/11 was used as a pretext and justification to wage war on an impoverished country in Central Asia. There were diplomatic exchanges between Afghanistan and the United States. People say the Taliban, but this was the government of Afghanistan, whether we like them or not. And they said, I think on two occasions, if there's evidence that bin Laden is behind these attacks, we'd be happy to hand him over to American justice. And George W. Bush said, we don't negotiate with terrorists. That was his response. So that avenue was not taken. And anybody who has a minimal understanding of military planning will know that you don't plan a large-scale theater war in the matter of 4 weeks. This conference took several months to prepare. Imagine anybody who has looked at so that the war on Afghanistan was in the pipeline well before 9/11. And 9/11 was the pretext and justification for waging this war using what former Central Command commander, General Tommy Franks, calls a mass casualty-producing event. It must be a military concept, a mass casualty-producing event, which, in the logic of Operation Northwoods, which was the secret plan to attack Cuba based on attacks in the Miami exile community with casualties, and that document envisaged precisely that, and then they said that the deaths of Cuban Americans would create a useful wave of indignation, which would then trigger a pretext and a justification to wage war on Cuba. That plan was never implemented. It was presented, it was under the Kennedy administration, it was presented by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. You can look at it, it's a declassified document. Robert McNamara at the time was Secretary of Defense, and I think that the White House turned it down. But the concept is certainly on record. Now, what I'd like to address is the fact that this event of 9/11 initiated what we might call the Al-Qaeda legend, namely that Al-Qaeda and leader Osama bin Laden constitute the outside enemy in the eyes of public opinion. And we saw that in the wake of these tragic events, immediately there was a mass mobilization of public opinion, and I don't think even sectors in Canada, I think everybody joined the bandwagon, virtually everybody, even trade unions, progressive organizations, and a few dissenting voices. My first reaction on the morning of 9/11, when George Tenet, head of the CIA, announced that Al-Qaeda and bin Laden was behind it, was twofold. One, of course, I was wondering how he could actually have done it from his hospital bed in Rawalpindi, because he was hospitalized, but we didn't know that at the time. So, But I then said to myself, but if Al-Qaeda is behind these attacks, who is behind Al-Qaeda? And I knew from the research I'd conducted on Yugoslavia in particular, but going back to the Soviet-Afghan war, that Al-Qaeda was an intelligence asset of the CIA. And this was amply recognized in numerous documents. And the response of the U.S. intelligence community was, we supported him, but he went against us. Okay? You can read that. I'm quoting literally from press reports, from intelligence reports. It's when an intelligence asset goes against his sponsor. Now, we were the sponsors of Al-Qaeda. It was for a good cause. It was to fight the communists in the Soviet-Afghan war. And we sent in the Mujahideen. We trained them in these CIA camps in Afghanistan and Pakistan. We set up the religious schools, the madrasas. We then contracted with our friends in Saudi Arabia to send in Wahhabi missions into Afghanistan to train these people. This is fairly well documented, and I don't think we need to extend the discussion on that. But the understanding of the intelligence community is he turned against us in the wake of the Cold War, the jihad, then started to target the Western world, and that 9/11 was an attack by Muslim terrorists. Now, the blowback, I can tell you that the blowback is a fabrication. It's an absolute fabrication, and that's absolutely crucial to an understanding of how this event then led to shifts in U.S. military doctrine, even in nuclear doctrine, okay? Even in the use of nuclear weapons, because they even say we might use a tactical nuclear weapon, a mini nuke, against bin Laden or against Saddam Hussein. I know, I read those documents inside out, and they actually say that. Now, when you look at a mini nuke, a B-61-11, it's something of the order between one-third and six times a Hiroshima bomb, okay? So it's no small bomb. It's a bunker-buster bomb, and that means you don't take out Osama bin Laden in his cave or in his hospital in Rawalpindi. Now, anybody who's been to Rawalpindi knows that it's a place which is swarming with U.S. military advisors. So how did he get into his hospital on the 9th of September for kidney, for his kidney problem? And then when was he released from hospital? Either on the 10th or 11th, but his whereabouts were known. Donald Rumsfeld said, "We don't know where he is. It's like looking for a needle in a stack of hay." Well, hello. Yes, bin Laden's whereabouts have always been known. Why? Because Al-Qaeda is a CIA intelligence asset and has always been an intelligence asset and continues to be an intelligence asset. So there is no blowback. And I will argue that there's a blow forward. There's a blow forward. I will discuss that later, but when the blow forward has to do with the fact that the main ally of NATO in the war theater in Libya is Al-Qaeda. And there's absolutely no ambiguity with regard to that, because the CNN is actually acknowledging it. But they say they're not Al-Qaeda, they're former Al-Qaeda, and that now they're pro-democracy, okay? But we'll discuss that a bit later.
You're listening to economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosorovsky. Today's show, Al-Qaeda and the Global War on Terrorism. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Shortly before 9/11, I was involved in researching the civil war in Macedonia. And in fact, I was in touch with the Prime Minister's office frequently by telephone and email, because what was happening is that a U.S. military mercenary company called MPRI, Military Professional Resources Incorporated, were advising both the Kosovo Liberation Army, which was integrated by Al-Qaeda units, Mujahideen, and they were also advising the Macedonian Defense Forces. And they were in fact coordinating the war on both sides. What happened now, just barely 2 months before 9/11, it hasn't been much publicized. The the Mujahideen were caught red-handed with their U.S. military advisors. These are all former commanders of the U.S. military. They're senior commanders. And they were caught red-handed together in the same unit or guerrilla unit. This led to a political scandal in Macedonia. The prime minister made statements and so on. So that barely a few months before 9/11, I knew that the intelligence asset was still working for the CIA and was still being used in covert operations. But then I also knew, and that's important, that Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda-affiliated organizations. Al-Qaeda is a very elusive concept. It includes quite a number of different organizations. But Al-Qaeda units were also being used in Bosnia in the early to mid-90s, integrating the Bosnian Muslim Army, and subsequently in the Kosovo Liberation Army, where Al-Qaeda was in fact involved, and they were also involved in training and so on, to the extent that they even people from different parts of the Muslim world were buying real estate in Kosovo at the time. But what I want to signify by that is that that throughout that whole period, the enemy number one, which allegedly committed these attacks, was in close liaison with their intelligence sponsors, the CIA, but also Pakistan's inter-services intelligence, which really operated as a go-between. Pakistan ISI was in touch with the terrorist organizations, the various organizations like Lashkar and Jaish in Pakistan, which were also involved in the training camps and so on, and that relationship has been maintained to this very day. The Pakistan Inter-Services Intelligence is virtually a subsidiary of the CIA, and it acts on behalf of the CIA. And I should mention another very important dimension is that in November 2001. And this was brought out in an article by Seymour Hersh, although he didn't really elaborate on the implications, is that Al-Qaeda combatants in Afghanistan were airlifted to northern Pakistan. They weren't sent to Guantanamo. Guantanamo was housed by civilians, people who were arrested left and right. The actual Al-Qaeda fighters were airlifted, and they were airlifted in military planes, and they were taken to northwest Pakistan, Waziristan, and that constitutes a new frontier, which today is the object of the drone attacks. So in other words, this is a very diabolical operation. You have to sustain these organizations as enemies of America, but also as assets. Now, an intelligence asset doesn't necessarily mean that these Islamic organizations know who their sponsors are. That's the whole point. An intelligence asset could be any one of us, okay? It's an instrument of U.S. intelligence. And it goes through different layers. And in this case, Pakistan ISI was a very important relay implementing U.S. Intelligence operations. Now, I think from my standpoint, and I focus mainly on geopolitics, I've focused on some other aspects of 9/11 which have been covered in these hearings, but the geopolitics of 10 years of war, that was, in fact, the theme of our conference in Montreal. 9/11 has unleashed a roadmap of war and destruction. We are at the most serious, we are at the crossroads of the most serious crisis in modern history. I think that's not an understatement. And the war on terrorism is part of that process. because it gives a justification to wage war on humanitarian grounds, so that you wage the war not against countries, but against what they called non-state entities, which came again into the jargon, that I think is very important. It provided at each stage, Afghanistan, Iraq, of course, it was another pretext, but in ultimately, the war on terrorism was also fought on the basis of the fact that there were terrorists with dirty bombs and so on. If we remember Colin Powell's presentation to the Security Council of the United Nations in February, in February 2003, preceding the invasion of Iraq, and ultimately the war on terrorism has been a continuum, what has happened is that this war on terrorism has also been supported by media fabrications. I think that 9/11 is the onslaught, and that's why 9/11 truth is so important. 9/11 is the onslaught of war propaganda, a higher level of war propaganda, where that actually happened immediately on the 12th of September. Okay, immediately on the 12th of September, there were calls to invade Afghanistan from what's his name, Sapphire, and various other pundits of the Washington Post and the New York Times, and said yes, we must go after the terrorists, and this all this has permeated the consciousness of millions of people. It's created an atmosphere of fear and intimidation, which was then coupled with the coded alert, the color-coded alerts, and Homeland Security, and so on. And it was a pretext to wage a war without borders, which in essence is a war of conquest, and it was also a pretext to implement far-reaching changes at home through the Patriot legislation, through national security, protection of borders, and so on and so forth. And I mean, you might even remember when you board the plane with your Johnny Walker Black Label, I should mention a word about the liquid bomb attacks, because they were totally fabricated, among many others. But the liquid bomb attacks, it turned out that the alleged terrorists did not have passports and did not have tickets to board the plane. Now, they must have screwed up somewhere, to say the least. But in any event, we went through a whole era of threats, of attacks on America. Okay, attacks on America, on the one hand, whereas in fact, what was happening was large-scale theater wars waged by America against countries around the world in various forms, either theater wars or covert operations or regime changes, and all of this was carried out under the banner of fighting the outside enemy, the elusive enemy, Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. And as you know, we saw, first of all, we see Al-Qaeda in Iraq, then we see Al-Qaeda in Yemen, Al-Qaeda in Africa. We had subsidiaries of Al-Qaeda virtually everywhere, you know. And wherever the United States needed to intervene militarily, they used the pretext of Al-Qaeda in Yemen or Somalia or wherever, under different names, and of course corroborated by media reports, etc. And in all cases, I can assure you, these are instruments of U.S. intelligence, or MI6, or Mossad. And there's a collaboration between them. What I think is of concern to us is that the 9/11 big lie sets the stage for what I describe as the American Inquisition. The nature of an inquisitorial doctrine is very different to actual disinformation. There's a subtle difference, because media disinformation is that you hide the facts and you obfuscate certain things and you lie. An inquisitorial doctrine is quite different. You don't necessarily need to lie. You don't obfuscate the torture camps in Guantanamo. In fact, you do exactly the opposite. You make them visible. Why? Because ultimately they are accepted as something which we can do. So torture then is accepted because we need to go after the bad guys. Okay? And so that an inquisitorial doctrine is based on essentially on enforcing the lie as the truth. Okay, it's not by obfuscating the truth and saying, no, well, this, that, and other. It's actually inverting the truth. It's transforming the lie into the truth. And then what happens is that this becomes a consensus. Responsibility to protect in Libya is a consensus. But in reality, what is it? It's the killing of thousands of people. And we've been following this war, and I can assure you the reports that are published. Our correspondent of Global Research, Mali Darius Nazarroya, who is in this room at this moment, has reported back from Libya, and the atrocities committed by NATO have not been mentioned in any of the media. And responsibility to protect becomes the logo. It becomes something that we accept, and so on and so forth. And so an inquisitorial doctrine imposes itself as a consensus that you do not challenge, because it emanates from the highest authority of the land, not only from the head of state and the U.S. Congress, but from Ban Ki-moon, Secretary General of the United Nations, from the ICC, criminal courts, and so on. Everybody toes the line, and everybody is committed to going after bin Laden. Okay, maybe I'm exaggerating. Let's say going after Al-Qaeda. But again, it's the war on terrorism, and then it's supported by and financed by Islamophobia and so on and so forth. And 9/11 is the ultimate, it's like Adam picked the apple. So it's the starting point. It's the starting point of this discourse and dogma, which permeates every area of society. And it cannot be challenged. It cannot be challenged. It can certainly be challenged in terms of factual information, but then people dismiss those facts because the Inquisition does not allow you to accept the truth. And so what I'm saying here is that the lie becomes the truth, and the truth ultimately becomes a conspiracy to challenge that consensus. And there's a NATO consensus now in Libya. There's a NATO consensus in Syria. But what is not reported is the fact that the war on terrorism is waged not against the terrorists, but with the terrorists. So that I call that the GWAT WTT. Okay, I should get intellectual property rights on that, but what WTT means with the terrorists.
You're listening to economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky.
Hey kids, today's we're just show. Doing a rebroadcast of Michelle Chavodowski from Guns and Butter in San Francisco. It's 7:45. It's chilly. It's frosty and icy out here at UBC. Put on some woolies.
Signifies that in every single one of these military operations, the terrorists have been waging a guerrilla warfare on the ground, paramilitaries trained, often trained by special forces, in Bosnia, in Kosovo, certainly in Afghanistan. Well, in Afghanistan it's a bit more complex, but in Iraq, as of 2004, when John Negroponte was sent as ambassador, his term was only for 1 year. His task was to put together the death squadrons based on the Salvador option, which he had applied in Central America in the 1980s. And these death squadrons were there as an instrument to obscure the role of the invader and weaken the resistance movement. Now, in Bosnia and Kosovo, we have documents which prove unequivocally that the United States military, well, the United States as an entity, was supportive of Al-Qaeda. And we get it really from the horse's mouth, which is the Senate Republican, it's the Republican Party Committee of the U.S. Senate. It's a document which was produced in 1997 and which is accuses the Clinton administration. Well, there was party politics involved in that. They accused Clinton of supporting Al-Qaeda and working hand in glove with Al-Qaeda and bringing in weapons into Bosnia. Okay? And so that is a document of the U.S. Senate. It's a public document. And we have other statements regarding the KLA. Now, we know that the KLA are listed by Interpol, and we know that the KLA is linked up with Al-Qaeda and so on. We know that the KLA was supported by NATO. So that is well understood, waging the war on terrorism with the terrorists, not against the terrorists. And I contend that that concept is absolutely fundamental. It's not the blowback, it's the blow forward. Because the blowback tells you that Al-Qaeda went against us, he's enemy number one. And the blow forward tells you that there's been a continuous relationship between entities of U.S. intelligence, Western intelligence generally, on the one hand, military as well, and entities linked up to the Islamic Jihad, what we now call as Al-Qaeda-affiliated organizations. And the reason why all this is important, because the lie penetrates the inner consciousness of people, it changes their perceptions, it prevents people from thinking, even when they're confronted with the fact that Al-Qaeda is in fact an instrument and not an object of the global war terrorism. But nonetheless, and when the lie replaces the truth in people's inner consciousness, there's no going backwards, okay? It's a very subtle mechanism. And the Spanish Inquisition understood perfectly well, but the French Inquisition was even worse. And it lasted for several hundred years, okay? That your whole mindset is subordinated to something which is predetermined and fake, and you cannot reflect. And now I'd like to blow forward, okay? Because it is a blow forward, and discuss very briefly two major areas of conflict today. One is Libya, and the other is Syria. Now, I can tell you unequivocally, and it's confirmed by media reports, that the main military units of the rebels in Libya are Al-Qaeda. The military commander in Tripoli is Al-Qaeda, or Al-Qaeda affiliated. These are former commanders of the Libya Islamic Fighting Group, the LIFG. Now, the LIFG is a CIA creation. These commanders, these mujahideen, were trained in Afghanistan, in CIA camps. The same procedure as those which fought in the Soviet-Afghan war, except in the subsequent period. I can tell you that the LIFG is still on the list of the State Department as a terrorist organization. and it's still on the United Nations Security Council list of terrorist organizations. And we know for a fact that the mainstay of these rebels are Al-Qaeda affiliated. There are other elements to the rebellion, which I won't go into. But the issue is the following. If you look at the press reports, they will acknowledge it. I think they have to acknowledge it because otherwise, you know, the truth might seep through. They acknowledge it and then they dismiss it. They say, and this is the way they go, they say, such and such is commander of the Tripoli rebel command. He's a former member of Al-Qaeda, but he is now pro-democracy. Okay? So what they do is they say these are former terrorists, former bad guys, and now they're good guys. Okay? So they're inverting the concepts. So you have a bad guy, and then CNN says, well, now they're committed to pro-democracy, etc., etc. They said the same thing in Kosovo with the KLA, that the KLA are criminals linked to the Italian mafia, but now we're going to use them to implement democracy. Now, essentially, this is what you have in Tripoli today. And these rebels are committing major atrocities directed against the civilian population. But what we have to understand is that the war on terrorism is not only a fabrication, but the enemy, the alleged enemy in this war on terrorism, is in fact a partner in the war on terrorism. Namely, Al-Qaeda is used in military operations on the ground, interfacing with NATO special forces and so on and so forth. And ultimately, this, I think, for us is very important that we can refute, because ultimately, if the war on terrorism is no longer accepted and doesn't have its legitimacy, the whole construct, military doctrine, collapses like a deck of cards. And that's why 9/11 truth is so important. The whole construct of global war on terrorism, it's not to say that they won't find other pretexts, but they won't be able to justify their war by lying to us and saying, so when I say the global war on terrorism is a WTT, okay, global war on terrorism with the terrorists, and it is not a blowback, but is a blow forward, and present-day wars in Libya are conducted by Al-Qaeda units on the ground. In Syria, we have a situation which is not quite the same, but what has happened is Salafist Muslim Brotherhood brigades have entered into Syria and are involved in acts of terrorist acts directed against public buildings, acts of arson, killing of police and armed forces and civilians, which then has led to response by the security forces. Certainly the government of Bashar al-Assad bears a burden of responsibility in this, but we have to understand what triggered the crisis in Syria. And the crisis in Syria was triggered by Al-Qaeda-affiliated units infiltrating protest movements and shooting. And they're shooting on civilians, that's well documented, and they're shooting on people. They're even shooting on Christian communities. And this is consequently not a protest movement, it is an insurrection. And the latest news that I have is that NATO is actually now, by Israeli intelligence sources, that NATO is itself in the process of recruiting Mujahideen, jihadist fighters, to wage their wars. They have a recruitment process, and it's an agreement between NATO and the Turkish military. Now, that those reports remain to be verified, but it is well understood that that recruitment process has been going on for a long, long time. And those brigades are there precisely to perform a terrorist role, which is used to destabilize societies, create sectarian violence. In countries such as Syria, is a country of tremendous religious tolerance for people who have been there. I spent more than a month in Syria earlier this year. And there's a sort of integration of Christianity and Islam to the extent that the prayer, I'll finish on that, the prayer at the Great Mosque in Damascus is taken from the Greek Orthodox Church. Thank you very much.
Best to explain it. You've seen me in X-Men.
Yeah.
The character I am, Professor Charles Xavier. Mm. If you remember, he can control things with the power of his mind. Can make people do things and see things. So I thought, what if you can do that for real? I mean, not in a comic book world, but in the real world.
All right.
So in my film, I play a man who controls the world with his mind.
Right. That's interesting.
Yeah. For instance, I'm walking along. And I see this beautiful girl, and I think I'd like to see her naked, and so all her clothes fall off.
All her clothes fall off?
Mm, yes, and she's scrabbling around to get them back on again, but even before she can get her knickers on, I've seen everything. You know, I've seen it all.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. We've already seen everything.
Okay. It's a comedy, is it?
No.
On terrorism. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Professor Kosudowski will take questions from the panel now. Judge Iposomato.
Thank you, Mr. Kosudowski, for your witness. And I ask you that I never read the news that you discovered the 12th September, the meeting that happened in Washington, in the department, between the chief of ISI, Omar Hamad, and the chief of the CIA.
Now, I have to refresh myself.
Hey, kids, we got a lot of feedback on the old feedback loop there, so just bear with me for 2 seconds while we change it out and put it onto the other feed. This is live radio. This is CITR. Yes, it's the end of the world news. And we're here this morning and we're doing a rebroadcast first because I thought this was of interest to people. Here's Chudovsky.
Mahmoud Ahmad was very important because he's head of the ISI. And at the same time, the ISI is known to support the terrorists, okay? But this is not, should come as no surprise because in effect, the ISI and the CIA work in tandem. But I should mention that prior to his arrival in the United States on September the 4th, there were meetings between two members of the U.S. intelligence community who were in